This is Newsmakers from Wisconsin Public Radio in La Crosse. I'm Hope Kerwin. While Wisconsin may be America's dairy land, there's no doubt that beer and brewing are a big part of our state's identity. The brewing industry was present in Wisconsin before it was declared a state, and the industry has played a role in the development of communities throughout the Driftless area. Joining us today to talk about the history of Wisconsin beer and its impact today is Doug Hoverson, author of a new book called The Drink That Made Wisconsin Famous. Doug, breweries were in Wisconsin, as I said, before we became a state, and the first commercial brewery was actually in Iowa County. I wonder if you can kind of share how this industry got started in our state.
Well, sure. The first breweries were really set up to serve the needs of the lead miners who were moving into the area around Mineral Point, where the first brewery was, and that entire area of Iowa and northern Illinois and southern Wisconsin was flooded with immigrants, many of them Welsh, who were miners in the old country and who, once they were here and working hard, decided they needed something to slake their thirst. And it became really expensive to ship something like ale into the region. So eventually John Phillips decided it would be profitable to set up his own brewery, and that became the first in the state.
And so I wonder if the tradition of home brewing that was also present in Wisconsin, you know, how maybe that influenced the commercial brewing industry?
Well, it's very likely that home brewing was going on beforehand. In fact, we have some fleeting documentation that there was home brewing all over the state before commercial breweries were in the area. But it seems it was one of those things that people didn't bother to write about because it seemed so natural. And as you say, I think there is a continuing thread of home brewing that goes through Wisconsin's history. It becomes especially important during the Prohibition years, when that was really one of the only alternatives for most people. And I think that tradition is really part of what helped the craft brewing boom get going, because without people who know how to brew and are interested in it, the breweries really don't have the labor force that they need to make all that beer.
I wonder if you could talk a little bit about the beer that was made during the late 1800s when this industry got started. I mean, how different is it from the drink that we know today?
One of my dreams, if I was allowed to time travel, would be to go back to around 1870 or 1880 and show up in Milwaukee or some other larger city on the day that the Bock beer was going to be released, so that I could test and see if it really was like what we know it as today. But I think by the time we get to the 1870s or 1880s, most of the commercial breweries have been able to use enough science so that they can regulate the fermentation temperature, they can evaluate the ingredients, and they're making very consistent beer. As far as the variety, there's a lot more variety back then than I think we sometimes think, because most of the major brewers were making several different varieties of lager. Sometimes they were making an ale and a porter as well. So a brewery in Milwaukee or some of the other mid-sized city might have made three or four or five different beers even in the 19th century.
So Milwaukee was obviously a central hub for beer in our state, but La Crosse was also considered a major brewing location. And I wonder if you can talk a little bit about what factors made La Crosse a good place for brewing beer.
La Crosse is really an amazing city because, given its relative size, it punches way above its weight class internationally as a brewing center. And I think probably the most important factor that separated La Crosse out from other cities of similar size was its location on both the river and several major railroad routes. It gave La Crosse a really good opportunity to expand their markets into Minnesota, into Iowa, and to the other states in the Midwest and the Mountain West, which hadn't had as much time to develop their own breweries yet, or hadn't had the type of immigrants who brought enough capital to start a brewery.
Yeah, so who were the major players in the early brewing industry in La Crosse, and how did that maybe change over time?
Well, there was a lot of movement back and forth. We think the first brewery in La Crosse was probably Jacob Franz, and it's not clear whether he started in 1850 or 1854. And one of the problems with researching this is we have evidence that there were breweries around before there were newspapers around that were interested in covering them. But within a few years, by the end of the 1850s, the big trinity of La Crosse brewers, the Heilemann, Gund, and Michael brewing empires, have all gotten started. And there was some movement back and forth. For a while, Michael was the biggest one, and then as we're heading into Prohibition, Gund was the biggest one. And of course, after Prohibition, Heilemann not only becomes the biggest brewer in La Crosse, but one of the biggest in the country, and really a major player in world markets.
Yeah, what do you think gave Heilemann its staying power and kind of contributed to this rise to fame for Heilemann Brewing?
Well, I think a big part of it was a skilled workforce. A lot of that was the German immigrants in the first place and their descendants. But I think moving into the post-World War II period, it was really just great management by a couple of their leaders, first by Roy Kumm and then Russell Cleary. And they had a vision for where they wanted to take the company. They had this plan, which was kind of revolutionary for the time, of buying up old breweries all over the country to get inexpensive brewing capacity, taking on some of their labels, and becoming a national brewer by becoming really a kind of multi-tentacled regional brewer.
Heilemann saw a huge boom, as you said, in the late 60s, early 70s. But eventually, you know, we get to the 80s and we see this merger and with another large brewing company. What happened that kind of led to Heilemann, you know, going that direction?
Well, there were several factors. And of course, the most dramatic one was the Australian financier Alan Bond coming in the heyday of the leveraged buyouts, buying Heilemann for way more than he probably should have, and ending up with massive financial problems and what was at the time the largest bankruptcy in Australian history. But Heilemann also had some other limiting factors, and that was that a lot of their breweries, both in La Crosse and around the country, were in constant need of upgrades, and they had old breweries that needed remodeling, they needed new equipment, and there was a lot of money that they were pouring into it. And at the same time, they had to put more money into advertising their beer to compete against the beer craze of the 70s and 80s, Miller Lite.
You know, I think one thing that's interesting about Heilemann is that kind of during its expansion period, you know, they were buying up other brands of beer and still keeping those on the market. And I just wonder if you can talk about maybe, you know, those different brands and why that move to keep those items on the market rather than just bringing them under a single brand.
What that really gets at is the amazing customer loyalty that many beer brands have had. And beer is really special in that way because there aren't a lot of companies and other businesses where the founder's name is still on the company generations later. And Wisconsin especially has great loyalties to its local beer brands, which is why so many of them survived. And Heilemann's strategy was to take some of those, for example, the Schmidt brand made in St. Paul, and keep those loyal customers and, if possible, move in some of their own labels like Old Style and Special Export, but really just to build on what was already there. Now, in the brew house, it ended up being the case that a lot of those beers were all the same thing and slightly different labels, but you know, you couldn't tell my grandfather that. He had his loyalty and he would never drink Schmidt, even though the beer he was drinking was really just Schmidt beer.
You're listening to Newsmakers on Wisconsin Public Radio in La Crosse. I'm Hope Kerwin. We're talking about the history of beer in the Cooley region and beyond with Doug Hoverson, author of a new book called The Drink That Made Wisconsin Famous. I want to talk a little bit about Old Style because I think for this area, you know, it's definitely the most recognized Heilemann brand. And, you know, I wonder if you could talk a little bit about the evolution of that beer.
Sure. Old Style goes back to the turn of the 20th century, and it was going to be Heilemann's big bottled product, and that was going to be the beer that they were going to start building their regional reputation with. And for people who have grown up in La Crosse recently and remember the world's largest six-pack with the old Style Shield labels on it, looking at some of the older labels in the book would be kind of a revelation because they were incredibly busy labels with all sorts of scenes of brewing depictions. But Old Style became one of those great American lagers for quite a while. It was the biggest beer in Chicago, and it was popular all over the upper Midwest, and they had great commercials. And it was interesting because it was one of the last beers to actually talk about an important part of the brewing process in the ads. They talked about kreuzening, which is part of the fermenting process where you add a little bit of green beer into the, not green colored beer, but fermenting beer into the fermenters to get a nice carbonation to it.
You know, how did Heilemann's Brewing Company, how did that brewery end up in the hands of City Brewing, which is where we see it today?
That was a situation where after the Bond bankruptcy and after the merger with Stroh's, the brewery essentially shut down, but it was so important to the local economy that a number of local business people pooled their resources, pooled their talents, and made a move to restart the company again, and reverting back to its original name from the pre-prohibition era, which was the City Brewery.
You know, earlier you mentioned loyalty to beer in Wisconsin playing a huge part. And, you know, part of your book talks about the kind of history of brewing in small towns throughout Wisconsin, really, but also in the Driftless area. And I wonder if you can talk about how many of those hometown breweries kind of became a part of a city or a town's identity.
There were a lot of factors in that, and some of it was a matter of employment. It was often one of the larger employers in some of the river towns and some of the other places in the Driftless area. And part of it also was even back before the craft brewing era, there were a lot of breweries that became the center of their community. They usually had a tap room where locals could come in and get a free beer or two or six. And there were real, you know, the breweries ended up sponsoring sports teams of all kinds, baseball teams, bowling teams. Even small breweries would sometimes sponsor a 15-minute radio program. And as a consequence, the name of the town, for in a case like, say, Arcadia or Fountain City, ended up getting spread far beyond what it otherwise might have. And it was a real source of pride for a lot of the people who lived there.
Yeah, I'm glad you brought up Arcadia because I wanted to talk about kind of a unique thing that, you know, that brewery did by offering a free public tap. I wonder if you can kind of share that story.
Well, basically, it was a situation where anyone who wanted to stop by the brewery and have a beer could do so. Sometimes in these public taps, the guests would all have their own mugs hanging on a hook or sitting on a shelf somewhere, and they could come in and pour as much as they want. Arcadia actually got in trouble with federal regulators at one point because beer that was not packaged for sale outside the brewery wasn't taxed. And at one point, Arcadia was reporting that 14 or 15% of their beer was going out untaxed. And it turned out that part of it was the tap room. Part of it was also a leaky bottle filler, which made it look like they had way more people in the tap room than Arcadia probably even had. So they were getting questioned by the government, but it turned out they weren't actually doing anything wrong.
I mean, I think someone could look at that number today, a brewery, and, you know, think, how could they make money by giving away, you know, a significant portion of their beer for free?
Well, maintaining the local market was really critical for all these Wisconsin breweries, and especially the smaller town ones. And keeping the local residents happy and loyal was part of it that helped generate business for the local tavern accounts and just keep the goodwill generally. There were a few smaller town Wisconsin breweries that tried to make a big push and get into Milwaukee or become exporting breweries, and they ignored their home markets for a while. And it was really tough to regain that support once it looked like they were trying to move beyond their loyal customers.
Another small town brewery I wanted to highlight was in Trumplo. And it kind of has an interesting story, mainly because of the brewery owners. I wonder if you could talk a little bit about Jacob and Wilhelmina Melchior.
Yeah, they seem to be one of those classic German couples of the 19th century. The accounts we have is that they were both large people who enjoyed the products of the brewery, though, again, the accounts also say they were also very good and enthusiastic dancers. And Jacob was the brewer, but he really wasn't interested in paying any of the taxes, but his wife insisted that they do that. So for a while, the brewery was actually in Wilhelmina's name for most of the official government documents.
Bangor, I think also their history of brewing, you know, kind of highlights a unique way that the breweries kind of helped municipalities and how they actually helped with local infrastructure. I wonder if you could talk a little bit about, you know, how that brewery contributed to better, you know, water system in the municipality after a fire in the early 1900s.
Yeah, and that's a great example because as Heilemann advertised, it's the water, and the water is critical to brewing. It's the major component by volume, and good water will lead to a good beer. Even in these days when you can redo the water chemistry of your local water, it's still important to have a good tasting water. And access to municipal water meant that the water supply was going to be much more reliable. And Bangor, in the immediate pre-prohibition era, they really partnered with the city. And whereas the city owned the water mains, the brewery owned the pumps. They took care of supplying fire protection. They had the public fountains. So most of the water was actually coming from the brewery's equipment and being carried throughout the city. And when water restrictions were imposed during World War I, the Husse Brewing Company there was able to get around some of those water restrictions by pointing out they were actually providing city water. It was not just water for the brewery.
How do you think these breweries throughout, you know, southwestern Wisconsin area kind of set the stage for today's craft breweries?
I think a lot of that had to do, again, with the idea that they were a center for the community to gather. I've sometimes referred to brewery tap rooms as a late afternoon and evening coffee shop or coffee house where you can go sit around, talk, play games. Some of them are dog friendly and become a gathering place. I think another thing is that it is similar in a way to the mid-19th century when immigrants were coming over to start up new businesses. Now we have entrepreneurs who have developed a skill and would like to start a new business. I think the one way in which it's noticeably different than 150 years ago is the huge variety of different beer styles that are made by our craft brewers today.
Yeah, I'm glad you brought up this, entrepreneurship in the brewing industry. I think that's a huge part of today's craft brewing industry. And I wonder if there are lessons that, current breweries can learn from the breweries that were started in our early history.
That's a great question, because one of the things I was really hoping to do was come up with some sort of thesis about why some breweries survived and some didn't. And I think my thesis ends up being is that there were a lot of different reasons, and most of the cases were individuals. Sometimes it was a matter of making good beer or bad beer, but there were a lot of breweries that made good beer that closed down. I think one of the reasons that a lot of breweries closed in the 19th and early 20th century was simply because they ran out of family members who were interested in keeping them going. And I think we're a little bit too soon into the craft brewing movement yet, because we haven't really seen too many second generation craft breweries going yet. But I think we're getting there. And as we start to have more breweries that are celebrating their 20th and 30th anniversary, we will see more about the staying power. But I think the breweries who have done a really good job staying in business are ones that have created a particular niche with particular styles of beer, and who have created an atmosphere in their tap rooms and around their product that's appealing to a large group of consumers.
In what ways do you think beer and brewing, the brewing industry, has influenced the development of the Driftless area? Are there impacts to our communities today that you think can be traced back to this start of this industry?
It's tempting to claim that everything in Wisconsin is somehow based on beer, and I don't really think I can go quite that far. But there are clearly aspects of many cities and towns' infrastructure and footprint that were in some way determined by the brewery. There are a number of cities that have a brewery street. The railroads in many cases had spurs added on to serve the railways. Sometimes the city even moved to accommodate the railway because of the brewery. And I think that in a lot of cases that brewery ended up being a major local landmark. Sometimes it was the tallest building in town. And I think throughout La Crosse especially, you can still see buildings, not just, of course, the Heilman complex, but there are pieces of the Gund Brewery still on the southern side of downtown. There are bits and pieces of some of the other buildings around. There's even still some of the caves that other breweries like Diefenthaler used back in the 19th century.
Doug Hoverson, author of The Drink That Made Wisconsin Famous, joined us today to talk about how beer and brewing shape the Driftless area and the state, and what impacts the industry still has on our region today. You're listening to Newsmakers from Wisconsin Public Radio in La Crosse. I'm Hope Kerwin. To hear audio archives of today's show, visit our website, wpr.org/newsmakers. From Wisconsin Public Radio in La Crosse, this is Newsmakers. I'm Hope Kerwin. Today we're talking about beer and breweries, exploring the industry's history in the Driftless area and the state of current craft breweries operating in La Crosse. Joining us now to talk about the present-day brewing industry are Joe Kachaver, founder and brewmaster of Pearl Street Brewery, and Phil Humphrey, owner and head brewer of 608 Brewing Company. Joe, Pearl Street Brewery has been around for around 20 years now, and I wonder if you could share a little bit about what drew you to the brewing industry and maybe how the industry has changed since you kind of started brewing.
I got a job at a brewery like 25 years ago, and I've been working in the brewery industry ever since. What drew me into it was that was kind of at a time when there wasn't a lot of craft beer around, certainly not around here. I was living in Colorado at the time where there were craft breweries, and who knew what the craft beer industry would eventually become. But at that time, it was pretty new, and people weren't, the average person wasn't that familiar with craft beer. So I thought it was a cool industry to get into. Plus, I love beer, so it was a natural fit. I just got a job at a brewery and stuck with it, and eventually went back to school for brewing. And then, you know, one thing led to another, and then opened my own brewery here in La Crosse. So that's kind of how I got involved in it. As far as changes today, I mean, it is drastically different than it was even 5 years ago, let alone 20 years ago. I mean, the craft breweries started out trying to emulate, you know, European beer styles, like trying to make a Irish stout or trying to make a, you know, a British ESB or something. Oh, I make one. We make them as good as the Brits do. And that was like what people hung their hat on back in the day, you know, when this was sort of in its infancy. And now the Europeans are emulating American craft beers, because I think it's just an American thing to take something and blow it up and make it bigger, better, faster, whatever, than what it was before. And that's just kind of an American thing. That's what Americans tend to do. And that's what Americans have done with beer, really just take it to the outer limits. And that's where we're at right now.
Yeah. Do you feel like you've been able to kind of, you know, explore like that creativity in beer making?
Yeah. Yeah. I love it personally, because I, you know, trying to brew without limits is acceptable now. Like, hey, let's put anything in beer, and maybe you have a winner, maybe it's not so great, whatever, but you can do it. Years ago, I couldn't produce sour beers. I couldn't produce a lot of things because people just didn't have a taste for them. You know, I'd brew these beers that have five people that were really, really excited about it, and everyone else thought it was garbage, you know. But nowadays, people's palates have changed and evolved. People are accepting mixed fermentation beers, which were just unacceptable not that long ago. People are getting excited about, you know, weird barrel-aged beers, beers with different fruits and non-traditional brewing ingredients, non-traditional yeasts and bacterias. And this stuff, I mean, brewing beer has been around since the dawn of time, so all this stuff's been done before. So the experimentation with us is kind of a more recent thing in you know, American beer history, which this is going to go down as one of the greatest times in beer history ever in the history of the world. So I'm glad that Americans are at the forefront of that.
What do you think drives that kind of change in consumer palates? And, you know, how do you, as a, you know, someone in this industry, you know, kind of work on marketing new innovative beers?
Well, the marketing part, yeah, that's tough. My focus, and I guess my art, is in the brew house and designing the beers themselves, and then naming them and coming up with a concept for them. And I understand that stuff has to happen. You can't just call it, you know, beer number six. So the marketing, especially in this marketplace, extremely competitive, crazy competitive marketplace out there. So yeah, marketing plays a big role in it. Usually we just kind of throw ideas around, and then one sticks out and everyone laughs and thinks it's great, and that's the one we end up going with.
Phil, 608 Brewing Company has been open for a little over a year now. And so I wonder if you could talk a little bit about how you got your start kind of in this industry.
I had been brewing, home brewing for 8-9 years, and usually would try to make styles that I couldn't get locally, that I, or, you know, I'd gotten drinking California or East Coast beers. Just kept going with that to the point where I was loving that a lot more than my day job that I was doing. I was an IT consultant, to the point where I was just kind of like, all right, I've always wanted to own my own business. I'm like, how can I get into this? I've been trying for probably 3 or 4 years. It was an idea in my head that I'd been working on, you know, a matter of finding the right pieces to fall in place. And, you know, I finally found the right people to help make that happen. And the other thing, too, that really pushed me into it is I really like travel. When I travel, I'm a beer tourist, a beer and food tourist. So, like, I was kind of bummed that La Crosse only had a couple breweries. I was fine with the breweries, for sure, but, like, I definitely want it, you know. Like, it's a big enough area. I felt like it could support another brewery, two or three, possibly. So I just, you know, kept pushing and pushing and finally got the motivation and, like, said, I have to take this leap. Otherwise, I'm going to regret it for the rest of my life type thing. I'm super happy I did. I mean, the brewing industry locally was awesome. I mean, Joe's helped me out with stuff. Brent has helped me out with stuff at Turtle Stack. And even Todd over at Skeleton Crew Brew have all been very helpful. And I appreciate all that for sure.
Yeah, I mean, what have been maybe the biggest challenges and maybe some accomplishments that you guys are proud of over this last year of business?
Challenges were ingredients. I like to do a little some stuff that's kind of out there. When you're like he was talking, how it's pretty much you can throw anything in a beer now, and I kind of keep pushing that a little farther every time I feel. But I didn't realize how hard it is to get certain hops. Some things that because when you homebrew, you can always kind of find anything because it's like just a little. You go to a store, you buy a couple ounces. Well, when you need to buy 100 pounds of it, or you know. Contracts come into play. A lot of the logistics of brewing at this at a larger scale were probably the biggest issues I had early on. I feel like I have a pretty good grasp on that now. But otherwise, I can't complain. We opened in about 6 months, which is pretty unheard of. We had smooth paperwork, ran smoothly. The brewing side. The business side of the brewing side has been the biggest challenge, and I enjoy that, though. I find it's fun.
How do you think your entrance into the brewing industry is maybe different than Joe's was 20 years ago? Do you feel like things are different now for people coming into this industry?
Yeah, way different because, I mean, like Joe said before you're trying to emulate European styles, the game was go big or go home, you know, get your beer out there, as many stores as you could, where now everyone's focusing on a taproom model. Because really there's no way to, if I could not open my size brewery and try to compete in the grocery stores, because I, first off, wouldn't be able to produce enough product. Second off, no one would know who I am. And, you know, why am I going to buy my beer over, you know, Sierra Nevada or, you know, someone that's been around forever. So a taproom allows you to basically highest profit margin, most sustainable, lowest staffing. It's definitely way different than it used to be, for sure.
Yeah, Joe, what are your thoughts on kind of this issue of how things are different maybe for people getting into this industry? I mean, is the popularity around craft breweries, is that a good thing? I imagine it's driving demand for a product, but also, as you mentioned, there's a lot of competition in this industry.
Yeah, the differences between back then and now are huge, not just the beers themselves, but I think it's a trade-off. I could easily sit here and say, oh, it's easy now. Everyone knows about craft beer, and opening one is like a rubber stamp thing, whereas I had to go to 3 or 4 months of council meetings to convince the city to let me open a brewery in the city limits, you know, within the downtown area anyways, and they just didn't understand. In this town, they thought a brewery, every person, when they thought of a brewery, they thought of Heilemann. They're like, what? What do you think you're doing? No. And I was like, well, it's more like a restaurant kitchen than a Heilemann Brewing Company, you know? And now everyone just knows that. So it's easy. Just, okay, cool. Paperwork's easy. The TTB, which is the federal government agency that regulates breweries, has come a long, long, long way. Like, they didn't even have computer you couldn't fill out forms on the computer back then. You literally had to do them all, like get forms, fill them out, send them in, and wait months sometimes just to get a simple answer about anything. And now it's like fill it out online, a couple clicks, and it's approved within 10 days sometimes. So in that respect, things are easy for the new brewer coming in. However, on the other side of that is the lack of exclusivity. So now you're coming into a market that's flooded, that's just saturated with other breweries, and that's tough. When I opened my brewery, like there were no breweries around here, so I was getting away with a lot of stuff that like Phil couldn't get away with making some mediocre beer because people know what good beer is supposed to taste like nowadays. And I could 20 years ago, I'd be like, yeah, let's try this. Oop, that didn't work out, you know? So nowadays you can't do that stuff because people won't be fooled. You know, they're smarter. They have better palates. They're more developed. They know that what a good beer is supposed to taste like. So there's a lot of differences in entering the market in these two different eras, I guess you could say.
That's Joe Kachaver from Pearl Street Brewery here with us today to talk about beer and breweries in the Cooley region. He's joined by Phil Humphrey from 608 Brewing Company. You're listening to Newsmakers on Wisconsin Public Radio in La Crosse. I'm Hope Gerwin. Yeah, Joe, you mentioned Heileman Brewing Company. And, you know, in the first half of the program, we talked about kind of the history of brewing in this region, but also in the state of Wisconsin. How do you think that impacts your business today?
When I first had the, you know, idea of opening a brewery, I was living in Colorado, and I was going to open a brewery out there, and it just, the stars didn't align for me out there. So I said, well, I'm going to go back home to Wisconsin because there's a lot less craft breweries, and it's Wisconsin. You know, it's a beer state. Everyone knows that. It has a reputation as being a beer state from all the breweries that were built in the state back in the mid and late 1800s, including the G. Heileman Brewing Company. And so I just think that means people know about beer, people drink beer, it's accepted. The average person's like, well, go get a beer instead of going and get a drink in a beer state or a cocktail or a glass of wine. You know, they're going to go grab a beer because this is a beer state. And I don't know, maybe that's not so much true today. But one thing I'll say is that being in a beer town as opposed to a city that's never had a big brewery in it is vastly different. When you're in a beer town, like I grew up in Milwaukee, so that's a beer town. People drink beer there every day. They go to the bar, they socialize at bars, they drink beer. You don't ever go out and get a cocktail with your buddies. And I'm speaking pretty generally here, but just where I was at when I grew up, that's just how it was. And being in La Crosse, it's the same thing. These people are familiar with beer. They know many people. I'm talking back when Heileman was open. You know, they knew many people that worked at the brewery. They themselves probably worked there at one point in their lives. It was a big factory with a lot, employed a big chunk of people, and there was a lot of pride in that. You know, they're certainly not going to work at Heileman and then go out and drink another competitor's beer. They wouldn't be caught dead doing that, you know. And neither would their family and their relatives and all that. You'd be getting a lot of heat if you did. And that's just how things were. And that's part of being in a beer town, a town that's had one of these big old breweries in it for a long time. And I've lived in cities that didn't have that. And there's nothing there. People are like, beer is, I don't know, more of an afterthought as opposed to like a kind of a daily sort of thing.
Phil, I wonder what your thoughts are on how La Crosse's kind of history of brewing influences your business today.
Yeah, I mean, I'm kind of along the same lines as Joe with this. Like, you definitely have that beer culture here. You know, we're slowly getting more people into the craft beer because I still think we're not really capping. You know, we're not really tapping into a large percentage of people here because a lot of people still want to drink the macro beers, you know, but we're slowly building and cutting into that culture a little bit more with as every year goes by, and you know, having all these beers come out between the four or five breweries in the area, like you're starting to get a lot of choices. And I mean, I don't know, but I've been to your tap room; it's slammed most days too. You go in there and they're all getting flights. So like the beer culture, they want to try everything you have. So when you come out with new stuff, they're all about it. And obviously Oktoberfest is huge here. You know, that's an event. I mean, I hate to say it, but it's really just based around having fun and drinking good beer. So I think the culture here is awesome. I think it really helps keep all of us going strong and surviving.
I do also want to you know, talk about the other side of this culture, because there has been an effort and continues to be an effort in the community to maybe talk about the high prevalence of risky drinking in La Crosse. So, Phil, I just kind of wonder what your thoughts are on that conversation and maybe what your role is, too, in that.
Sure. So, I mean, that's always what's going to make the news, right, is anything bad happens. And as soon as they see beer, people get out the pitchforks. I like to think craft beer industry, though, for the most part, our target audience is not usually the binge drinkers. It's more of the people coming in. They're traveling through town. They want to stop in and, you know, hit every brewery. So they're not going to go there and pound 10 beers. I also think the craft beer price points are a little higher than, you know, going down to the local bar and getting whatever's a buck for the day, you know, and just keep pounding through it. So I think that kind of helps fight that. I don't disagree that there's probably some overusage in the industry itself. But I mean, just gotta be responsible. Like, we can't babysit everybody. You know, we're not going to serve somebody that's intoxicated, but at the same time, you know, people need to have a little self-control, and you know, it can get out of hand, but I don't think we're trying to feed into that culture at all. We do it because we like making a unique product that we believe is a higher quality than, you know, some hard seltzer that you can slam all day and doesn't even feel like you're drinking. I mean, if you're drinking that fast, that hard, that your end goal is probably intoxication, right? That is definitely not the route I want people to go down.
Yeah.
Because I want people to enjoy their experience at the brewery and want to come back again, not drink too much they can't remember it.
Yeah. Joe, what are your thoughts on maybe breweries' roles in this conversation that's happening here in La Crosse?
Well, I think agree with Phil on some points. The craft beer industry is not so much geared around binge drinking as much as was kind of portrayed by the bigger, older breweries, you know, big pitchers, you know, big giant, you know, like Oktoberfest steins with giant amounts of beer in there. And it's just kind of a different culture and price point as well. We're making like what you could consider a boutique product with very expensive and eclectic ingredients in it. And the goal here is to make amazing beer it's more along the lines of a really fine meal at a expensive restaurant, as opposed to a, you know, just grabbing a few burgers and or some pizza and throwing them down. I don't really know how to equate that, but to me, being in business for a long time, it is far worth it for me to turn somebody down, you know, at our tap room and say, yeah, maybe how about a glass of water, buddy? You know, when they're starting to get loud or obnoxious, which doesn't happen that often. It's worth it to me to send somebody home safely and they're going to come back another day and then make another 10 bucks off them or whatever, and then have them just be leaving my place drunk because they're getting in a car. Everyone drives to my, because of the location of where we're at. Very few people walk there. A lot of people ride their bicycles. But then they're getting their bicycles out into traffic. That's just as treacherous for them, you know. So it's just, it's worth it for us to, one, we close early. We don't stay open until bar time. We could. A lot of people ask me why we don't. And I just said, well, you know, after midnight at a bar, I mean, people are, they're just getting hammered, right? And we're closed. You know, we might be at a bar somewhere getting hammered ourselves. You never know. No, but I just mean, like, we close early, so we're not part of that late night, super hammered scene, I guess you could say. We're also, we offer safe rides to all of our patrons of our place. So any night you think you have too many beers, you can get a free ride home on the brewery. So, and then come back and get your car the next day. It's fine. You can leave in our parking lot overnight. No biggie. We want people to be safe and really, I don't know, I've changed over the last 20 years myself, and I'm just not into that spending all day just getting peeled anymore. Yeah,
I don't know if I've been to almost every brewery will do that for you, for sure. I mean, like he said, I'd rather not serve you than further the problem.
Yeah. Joe, I wonder also what, you know, we've seen a distillery, La Crosse Distilling Company, open up in downtown, and there are more and more wineries in this area. How does that kind of the popularity of other forms of, you know, craft alcohol kind of play into your business?
I think it's great to see local options for almost anything, especially when it comes to the more pleasurable things in life, like beer and wine and liquor, if that's your thing. And I, big part of our kind of mantra at Pearl Street is support local. And that just came from the fact that people have been supporting us for so long. and we've really, you know, loved this community and want to see it improve and get better, and that all fits into that support local. And to see other local options, so you don't have to go buy, you know, a Jack and Coke, you can actually get a drink at the distillery, and they also sell their products at other, you know, other bars and restaurants around town. So you can go buy a locally made liquor and wine. There's a lot of great wineries around here now too. So I just think that's great. I don't know if, I mean, there's a little bit of crossing of beer drinkers with wine drinkers and liquor and whatever, but for the most part, people drink what they drink and stick to it, I think.
Yeah, Phil, I wonder if they're, I don't know. I mean, is there a possibility that the market could become oversaturated? I mean, is that something that weighs on your mind?
I mean, locally, I think we're far from oversaturated, but I mean, there's definitely a lot of breweries now. There's like 7,000 plus breweries in the United States, I think, and they're starting to fail. Like he had mentioned earlier, like now you have to bring a quality product. If your product isn't good from the get-go, you have one impression. And I mean, a lot of times your first impression with beer, maybe you're still working kinks out of your system, stuff like that. You know, some people will give you a second chance, but some people won't. They'll be like, well, not good, not going to come back. So, I mean, overall, in the whole picture, yes. In this local area, I don't think so yet. I mean, I think it's just adapting. The it's different now. You know, people like to go to the source. I mean, they don't always, if you go to a grocery store now, I mean, you could probably speak more to that. It's tough. There's literally 1,000 choices, and you have to, like, what's going to differentiate your brand there. So I see that being a tougher market right now. But as long as you can still get people to come right to you, like you said too, support local, like a lot of people in La Crosse just love having these options. As long as, you know, we're all putting out a good product and, you know, being supportive of the local community and helping out, I think we're okay right now in La Crosse.
Yeah. Joe, I mean, what, as you look forward to the future and this, you know, competitive marketplace, kind of what's next for your brewery? What strategies are you taking to, you know, make sure your beer stands out?
Well, we've evolved, like I was talking about earlier with our beers, have certainly evolved over the years. And we make a lot of beers that never actually make it out into the market. We just sell them at our tap room. That's kind of how we introduce new products to the world, is just at our tap room, and they usually go unannounced, or, you know, maybe there's a post put up on the internet, but other than that, we just put these beers out there and just see how people like them. We have a slot on our beer lineup that just says R&D beer, and these are beers that we don't want to tell people what they are. We don't even tell them what beer style it is or what it's like. We just, unless they really, really want to know and they start asking a bunch of questions. Otherwise, we just say, here, try it, you know. And that way, we just get people's opinions on a beer. And from that point, beers evolve. We might put some thought into what we're going to name them, or or maybe some cool designs for a label. So the evolution of beer in our brewery, that's kind of how it all starts. And eventually, it makes its way into a bottle. We just bought a canning line. So we'll be rolling out beer in cans this winter and into next summer. And we've explored other, you know, product lines. And we work closely with Hoke Orchards in La Crescent or Noadine up there on the ridge. They have an organic farm. It's the Hoke family. So we work closely with them to help them produce their stuff and get it packaged with our resources. And they're good friends of ours, and they make ciders, which is not the same as a beer, and breweries can't make ciders because of the, you know, the law, and the ciders are considered wine because it's a fruit-based product. So we've expanded a little bit in that way and gotten some licensing to allow us to work with those guys and produce or help them produce their organic ciders too. So I was exploring and looking at different options and fun ways to, promote our brewery and turn out some new products for people to enjoy.
Yeah, Phil, what's next for your brewery?
That's a good question. Still so new, like we had a good first year. Been keeping the tanks full all the time. So it's like, trying to decide whether I want to sink a lot more money into more tanks or possibly different place to brew at some point. That's not going to happen this year by at all. But it's just, yeah, right now I'm just riding it out probably for another 6 months or so, see if the numbers continue to stay the same or improve and not drop. And just because, you know, you're new, so you get that nice bump and you don't know if it's because you're new or if it's because you're doing something really good. So we're kind of just holding tight right now, I think. You know, we did buy a canning line, a small canning line earlier this year. That's been helpful. I'm still just working on maybe just, you know, more canned stuff and hopefully start getting some barrel-aged beers coming out. But as for anything massive, probably not this year.
Phil Humphrey from 608 Brewing Company and Joe Kachaver from Pearl Street Brewery joined us to talk about the challenges and opportunities facing breweries in the La Crosse area. And that's Newsmakers from Wisconsin Public Radio in La Crosse. I'm Hope Kerwin. Our show is produced by senior news editor and producer John Davis. If you missed part of today's show, including our interview on the history of brewing in the Coulee region, you can find the audio archives at wpr.org/newsmakers.